Well, my name is George Soling. I work for the Institute of Marine Science at the University of Alaska. During the flood of last August, I did some work with a boat, and what would you like to know about it?
When did it first come clear to you that we were facing a major flood in the area?
Well, my neighbor woke me up at about 4 o'clock on Tuesday morning, which I believe was the 14th. And at that time, the water was just starting to move down the street in front of the house. And at that time, I decided that all we'd heard on the radio and the TVs for the night before was completely erroneous, and obviously they didn't know what they were talking about.
I mean, in reference to the prediction of the crest.
Right. Their statement that the crest was 30 to 40 miles upriver and would crest at midnight was completely false, but yet it was on TV all night the previous evening. Because by 4 o'clock the next morning, the flooding was in the area that I live in was a good 4 or 5 feet higher than it was the night before.
This is Monday morning.
Tuesday morning. We got our neighbor's wife and youngster out of their house from across the street. We all had breakfast and proceeded to get, at that time, as much out of the basement as we could. By 6, the water was coming into the basement, and we decided at that time to get all of us into the boat and get them up to the university. By that time, it was quite easy to go through the back streets and down the slough and on up along the railroad tracks right up to University Avenue. And I dropped my family off with some other people and then continued on the rest of the day until about 11 o'clock Tuesday night, getting people out of their homes up to the campus.
And what area particularly? In other words, where is your house? Where did you start from?
Particularly in the Aurora area. I was there almost most of the day, and then late in the afternoon and evening I was working at getting people out of the Lameda area. And later on in the evening, about 9 o'clock, we went on over to Fairbanks, registered with the Fairbanks Police Department, who, by the way, had lost their records of all the registration of boat operators.
So before Tuesday night, it was all day Tuesday, you were operating on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any contact with somebody in authority or supposedly in authority?
None whatsoever. There was no contact with anyone. In fact, our contact with the city police on Tuesday night was rather discouraging, for the simple fact that it was obvious that there was a lot of things that needed to be done. And we had a boat that was well equipped with a spare motor and two people that knew what they were doing, and we couldn't get any directions as to what they would like to see done at the moment. So we finally, after about an hour of waiting around at the police station, abandoned that and went back, worked our way back to the university. And by that time it was 11 or so, and we were exhausted and got some sleep.
You started off Tuesday morning with your boat and your motor, right?
Right. And the whole day was primarily concerned with getting people out of their homes. The major concern that I had, as did a number of the other fellows that were running boats, was people had not been, even at that time, still weren't convinced that there was a catastrophe. No one on the radio or other methods had informed the people that there was a real emergency, and you know. So as a result, they were all, many of them were saying, no, we'll stick it out and stay at the house. My concern was that the water temperatures being around 46 degrees was such that if they started to panic and tried to walk out of their houses, even a few blocks, they would end up going into shock before they ever got there. Many people don't have any appreciation of what cold water can do to them. In 46 degrees, person fully submerged up to their neck can probably last about a half an hour. If he's a real strong individual, he might go longer. And before they go into shock, of course, once you go into shock, you just stiffen up and you've had the course. An example of one of this is one house that I got to that before I got finished, I took 40 people out of one house. They were standing in there. The first time I got to the house, they were in water that was up over their ankles in the living room. I asked them if they wanted to get out to the university, and this one fellow, ostensibly the leader, said, "Oh no, we're going to stick it out. It isn't going to go much higher." They all seemed to follow this person, so I left and went on to the next house and took a load down, and about an hour and a half, 2 hours later, I came back to the same place, and by this time the water was up over their knees. Well, I spotted a woman holding a baby. It was obviously a very young baby and turned out to be a 2-week-old youngster. I got to her and I asked her if she wanted to get her and her baby out, and she was almost in tears wanting to get out of there. And this sort of turned the tide against their leader, and they started piling into the boat. The next thing I know, this leader was sort of trying to give commands and directions, and insisted all the women and children go first. And this is very heroic. However, it doesn't have many practical advantages. And he sort of got a little annoyed at me when I insisted that at least two or three or four of the men come along. Because, as I pointed out to him, I said, if I get down that slough, whereas, and I get hung up on something or get in trouble in any way, I've got to have some strong men with me to give me a hand. There isn't much that I can do by myself with 20 women and kids in the boat. So it was divided up roughly half and half, and I got them all out. But I think that if the civil authorities, or actually even the military authorities, had just come right out early and declared martial law and said everyone is to get out of their homes now, they wouldn't have had this problem of convincing people that they had to get out. And the problem was twofold, in that is that as long as they stayed, you had a problem of feeding them, and water and sewage and all the rest of it. And the other is that if they did attempt to go out by themselves without a boat, they probably would have had more deaths. There were some amusing sort of things that happened with people recognizing that most of them were sort of in a pseudo panic condition. Rather amusing to see what some of the people wanted to take with them, like end tables and lamps. Most of the people were taking out heavy clothing and food, which was of course what they needed. But one interesting aspect of that was that of all of the people that I took out, which I estimate about 450 in that one day, I had to tell one individual to open up a bottle of beer for me because I was downright thirsty. I had to tell another woman, yes, I want a piece of cake and a glass of milk, because she was cutting some up for her youngsters and I was darn right hungry. I hadn't had anything. In fact, it turned out whole day Tuesday, I had eggs for breakfast at 4, and I didn't get another thing to eat until, I think it was 6 o'clock Wednesday morning. And on the other hand, one fellow, I come up to his trailer, a big house trailer, and they were all up on top of the roof. And as I moved the boat in alongside the trailer, trying to keep from punching holes in it, this fellow says, "Hey, here, this is for you." And he throws me a jug. He says, "I'm sorry, it doesn't have a cap on it, and there's a half a fifth of whiskey." So, yeah, I'm trying to catch the bottle and save that and not damage his house any further than it was. But other than that one fellow offering, tossing that bottle of whiskey to me, there wasn't a soul that offered anything. And yet they'd sit there and open up and feed their kids and open up soda and beer for themselves and so forth, and never once think about the guy that's taking them out. And in fact, one state trooper, which by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we were getting pretty desperate. We were out of cigarettes and food and so forth. We asked him if he could get anything for us. Our next trip back, we came back and he had a fifth of Canadian Club for us. That's all I could find. He said, just don't let the people see you drinking. He said, they might get a little worried about it. But my only real comments about the people is this, that for the most part, almost all of them were very happy to follow anybody who would tell them, you do this, you do that. I found that the easiest way to handle it was to be very autocratic about it, and just as people got into the boat, point at them, say, you sit down here, you sit down there, because if it didn't, they just end up standing there, what do I do now, you know, sort of thing. There's one other thing that was rather interesting about the people and how they reacted. Any number of them wanted to take their dogs. And one woman became rather upset with me when I refused to add 5 dogs, one of which had a litter of puppies, into the boat of 20-some people. And I had in the back of my mind all of the dogs and cats and so forth that were on the campus already. And I told her that this boat was for people, and if you want to be concerned about our dogs, to put them up on the roof and put some food up and water there, and they'll stay there very happily for about a week or so without any attention. They wouldn't really run away. But we did end up, in many cases, just putting all the dogs up on the roof that, rather than bringing them up on the campus where there was a big enough problem with animals anyway.
You said that you worked essentially the Lomita, Aurora area.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take you to get from Aurora up to the university and then back again?
Oh, of course it depended somewhat upon how many people had in the boat. But on the average, it would take me about 3/4 of an hour for a round trip. And then of course it also depended upon, like one house you got 20 people in one house and one load, and you turn right around and hit it off. Sometimes we'd end up going from house to house, and occasionally there was long discussions whether they wanted to leave or not. But the one thing that scared me about all of this was coming down that slough there by the railroad bridge. There was a great big tremendous log jam there. And my fear was to, if it ended up getting caught in that thing, get pushed up against the log jam, then the upriver side of the boat was down under. And the next thing you know, you got the boat turning over. And people I knew I shook up an awful lot of people by going full bore down that stream on the full left-hand side and then just going, headed right for some bushes. And they didn't know there was an opening there, but I'd been through it many times. And a number of times I just had to end up screaming as loud as I could over the roar of the motor to sit down and stay put. Well, I finally got to the point where long before I'd end up stopping the boat and telling people I was going to do something that they'd probably get shook up over, not to worry about. But one fellow did get his boat caught there, and he was towing another small aluminum boat. And it could have been very catastrophic. Fortunately, the two kids, his teenage sons that were in the boat that he was towing, the 12-foot aluminum pram type, got caught in there, and two kids jumped off of the boat up onto the railroad trestle and managed to get up on there. And but they lost the boat. But they could have very easily have gotten caught and pulled under the bridge themselves. But other than that, there was no real hazard in driving the boat. Of course, I knew the area pretty well. I'd been out early and knew where all the cars were parked so that I didn't get hung up going over cars like they were doing downtown where people weren't familiar where the parking meters were and where the cars were parked and so forth, and ended up running over the over these obstacles.
You were only downtown once Tuesday.
Tuesday night, yes. So we went down Wednesday as well. With on Wednesday night, with the same sort of mass confusion as to who was doing what in the police department. And there we ended up, that particular second night, we ended up with some problems that were rather amusing in one way, but could have been very deadly in another. We lost the nut and to our propeller, sheared the pin, and ended up without a prop. We managed to, we were just a half a block away from the police station. We got in, got another prop, and started to take off for the university. A couple fellows bummed and wanted a ride out, so we told them the conditions and so forth, and as luck would have it, we promptly got about 3 or 4 blocks down current from the police station and lost the second prop. So this fellow that we picked up said, well, let's paddle on up over here to the Arctic Bowl building and we'll take the motor off of my boat, which he'd sank his boat up there, but the motor was still out of water. So we got his and put it on my boat and took off again. And I used his motor and props and gas tanks and life jackets and so forth for the remainder of the period. It was just Monday night here, was it October 9th, that he came back to my house after I put an ad in the paper trying to find this fellow, because I never knew saw the guy before in my life. And he gave me a 35 Edmonton motor and some other supplies and goodies. And it's almost 2 months later he finally came back and picked the stuff up.
Then neither Tuesday night or Wednesday night did you get any kind of direction from the police or civil defense?
None at all.
They didn't. Did they supply any gas or any food for your operations?
We got gas down at the Texaco station on Cushman. This was long. This was on Tuesday night before we got to the police station, and we saw the gas station all lit up, and we were running low. And we just pulled up there, and it was, I'm not sure whether it was an Army individual running the operation or whether it was a civilian. But anyway, just fill up with whatever you need and sign the slip. And we got 35 gallons of gas with the appropriate amount of oil and took off. So, but all of the other gas that we used, we got from various people that had some in their garages and so forth. And before the week was out, I think we went through about, probably 150, 200 gallons of gas.
What were you doing most of Wednesday? This is probably when it settled down a little more then? Or were there still people that you were pulling out Wednesday?
Wednesday, we took a few people out who were staying on the roofs of their houses and finally decided they didn't really like the cold nights and so forth. Got those people up to the university. We're spending a lot of time getting people back and forth who had very particular urgent needs to get back to their house to check on something or do something, and then we were bringing these people back and forth. One fellow had a considerable collection of firearms that he was rather concerned about and worth a lot of dollars. And so we brought him in, he got these firearms out of his house and off somewhere where they were safe. Wednesday we spent a lot of time going around from house to house pulling mains fuse blocks, on the outside of the buildings. Turned out that there, of course, was very little salt in the water, and as a result, there was no real danger of fires, particularly from anything that submerged. But what we were worried about is when things, when the water went back down, if things were still on and power came back on, that there might be just enough water in there where they'd start to arc, and that's when you get a fire started. As a matter of fact, after I got back into my own house, the water was down below the first floor. I started turning switches on to get some power on upstairs, just in the kitchen in certain areas. I threw the wrong switch and got the oil burner on, and the oil burner came on under about 6 feet of water. And I could very definitely hear it running. So that even though, this is how clear the water was in terms of the salts that provide an electrical path, you see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, Wednesday it started to become apparent to us that there was a danger of looting over in the Aurora area. And by Thursday morning, we were convinced of it. One fellow reported about $2,000 worth of custom-made firearms stolen. And about this time we started to notice, and this is when I say we, there was about four or five boat operators in the Aurora area. We all know each other, we went back and forth. And we all started to put things together, and what it amounted to was that there were a couple of teenagers whose parents had abandoned them some months before and when they left for the lower 48. They were just roaming around, eating and staying here and there wherever people would take them in. And these two kids were seen in far too many houses to justify any real need for them to be there. So about this time, it was Thursday, I ended up coming back up here to the university to get a hold of Val George, who is the civil defense director here on campus, who I know personally. Got a hold of him, I said, Alice, we need to get some either soldiers or state policemen down the Aurora area. There's evidence of looting beginning down here. There's about 5 feet of water still in most areas. People can't get back to their houses. And he said, well, he says, I don't have any contact with the state police or the army. He said, why don't you check with Lou Haynes? Lou I know personally as well. I saw him walking down the hallway and I asked him. You know, he said, I don't know how to get a hold of him either. About that time, a fellow from the Salvation Army overheard the conversation. He said, asked me what it was all about. I told him. He said, well, let's go ahead and see if we can't talk to the police. So he gets on his little radio and calls the city police and asks them to relay the message to the state police. Which I thought rather amusing to find the Salvation Army had radio contact with authorities and the civil defense didn't. So, it was on Thursday, finally after a number of complaints on Thursday and Friday, on Saturday they showed up. And they had three soldiers, three state troopers, and a civilian in one boat with a 25-horsepower motor on it. And they came by where we were staying, which was up on top of the flat roof, and announced to us that they were there and not to worry, they were going to take care of all this looting problem. I'm afraid I was a little bit tired and a little bit short-tempered about it, and I asked them just who they expected to catch with it. Nicely loaded boat they had. And the fellow said, what do you mean? And I said, well, right now, I said, you're so heavily loaded that if you did spot somebody looting, I said, you know, you can only make about 3 knots against the current where you are right now. If I can take my boat out there and run circles around you. Whereupon the next day they came around with 2 men in a boat. But by this time the water was dropping to the point where people were starting to walk back to their houses and the water was down below their knees, sort of thing. And the looting danger was starting to diminish the more people they had back. But we in the process finally ended up deciding amongst ourselves that the only thing we could do is to patrol ourselves without any authority to do anything to anybody that we came across. And what we did, whether it was legal or not, was to, if we saw someone entering the house or around the house, we would stop, ask him who he was, what he was doing. Almost always we had an answer, this is my house, I'm so and so. Well, even at that, you can't, if you don't know the individual, you have no way of knowing that this is his house. It turned out that almost all, with the exception of one case, what we would do is we'd hold and just sort of stick around and hold on, and one of the other fellows would come by with his boat. And sooner or later, one of the fellows in the boat said, oh, I know this guy, yes, he does live there. And we'd forget him and move on our way. One case where there was no one could identify the individual, and he gave a convincingly enough story that we believed him, that he did live there. Coming back to these two teenagers, in the process of this, we finally ended up telling these two teenagers to, they were staying with Busby's, who owns that little cafe over there, to get inside. This was 5 o'clock in the evening, told them, do not show your face outside till 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, because if you do, you will get shot at. Whether you get hit or not, I don't know. He says, well, who do you think you are? I don't really care who you think I am, but if you stick your neck out, you will get shot. And after you get shot, you can worry about the legality of it. And whereupon they decide maybe they better go inside. It's unfortunate to have to do something like that. But on the other hand, it's better to keep a couple of kids inside wrongly than to have them outside and have somebody's property stolen. And they didn't really need to be out anyway. All they were doing was paddling around in the canoe. When you see them paddling around in a canoe around a house, and if somebody comes up the street in a motorboat, they paddle around the back of the house and around the other side as the boat goes by, you start to wonder what their intentions are. So, this I felt was, all came about would have, perhaps, maybe I'm wrong, but I think it would have been relieved if the Army had declared martial law, said everybody out, put in the troops, patrol, and so forth, and literally take over. And this, I think, was one of the real failures of the whole disaster, was that there was nobody that was in a position to tell and direct the whole operation. And as a result, we ended up with 5 organizations all fighting the other one, making sure he didn't get ahead of themselves. No one was willing to let someone else take over the leadership.
Did you see any examples of this?
Sure. City police wouldn't talk to the state police. The state police wouldn't talk with civil defense. Civil defense couldn't talk with anybody. You get down to the city police department, you ask them what they want, well, we don't know. And it was just a complete lack of coordination. At one point I saw a state trooper in one end of the room in the city police department and a city police force sitting in the other end of the room, and they wouldn't talk to each other. And part of this was probably the fact that they were tired. People were getting short on tempers and so forth, but it was just, I think, just a basic lack of communication and command decision. And this, what it amounts to is that somebody just has to step in and say, this is the way it's going to be. And after it's over, then you can argue about whether he was right or wrong, but at least for the moment you get things done. It was just like the fellow that loaned me that motor as part of the Air National Guard. And he told me that the Air National Guard started flying in supplies out to the airport. He said they found out that it was taking them 3 to 4 hours to get that plane unloaded. And this is Air National Guard and Air National Guard people. One of the commanding officers down in Anchorage started to get teed off that his planes were sitting up here for 3 hours before they got off the ground. So he came up on one of the flights. Wanted to find out why they couldn't be unloaded faster. And the commanding officer up here started to give him some explanation. He says, no excuses. Those planes would be loaded and unloaded in half an hour. This is the way it is. You, start unloading that plane. And he started commanding civilians. Anybody happened to be around, say, here, go to work. And he said, people would go to work for him just because they were told to go to work for him. Meanwhile, this other fellow was going around asking, well, we need some help, could you? And nobody would help him. So it was a matter of people coming up and saying, this is what you are to do at the moment. And people will do it. As long as it isn't saying, walk out into the middle of the river, they'll, you know.
Very much like you're finally having to tell people to get into the boat, kind of.
Yeah. Most people, I think, look for leadership, particularly in a time of disaster, because they don't really quite know what they're supposed to do, you see. And they're looking for somebody to tell them what to do. Of course, unfortunately, there's some people who will give the wrong commands, like this big jerk who was telling them, no, we're going to stick it out. There was 40 people that were following him because he said we're going to stay, and this was wrong. He shouldn't be. But people will follow anybody who tells them to do something when you get in this type of situation. At least that's the way it appeared to me. And this is why I think that the Army or any one of the agencies, if they just said, we're taking over the whole operation, and made it stick, and the Army person's in the best position to do this. Because theoretically, they've got the people and the facilities and the equipment to do something like that in such a large scale. And of course, the whole key to it is communications, which was horribly lacking.
Outside of that incident, excuse me, the incident in Aurora, did you see much of the Army and their work, whatever it was?
I saw the Army in a couple of major areas. Of course, everyone recognizes that if it wasn't for the helicopters that were flying. You know, I worked for Sikorsky Aircraft in their engineering department and done a lot of test flying with them. I got a little feel for what it takes to fly these things. And the flying that these guys were doing was good. And they just didn't waste any time. Those pilots were probably the best that I've seen, at least from what I could see on the way they handled their planes. I saw them landing downwind and in crowded areas where, under normal circumstances, nobody would even, you know, they'd say, well, it's not a safe place to land. But I've landed in a helicopter with a pilot flying it where he had 6 inches between his, on each end of his rotor blade, between the telephone poles on a ball field. I mean, you do these things. And these fellows were good. The other thing that I saw was with the Army was that they were, with their large vehicles, were transporting a lot of people, particularly from the university out to the airport down University Avenue, and also bringing back a lot of food and supplies from the airport. My only main criticism of the Army and the way they operated their vehicles was this, that they seemed to have a bunch of boys that could only operate their vehicles full bore. And they couldn't care less about what sort of wave they pushed. And some of those vehicles, the big tractor trailer types and tank vehicles and so forth, would push out a wave out in front of them. It was 2 and 3 feet high. And they didn't really slow down or anything. It could be a whole slug of people standing right close to the water somewhere, and they just keep right on going. They were told, apparently, by any number of people, including their commanding officers, to slow down. They just continued to go the same way. The Air Force personnel, apparently the word was given to them to slow down their vehicles, and they did. I think, which is a reflection on the basic intelligence levels of the Army personnel versus Air Force people.
Yeah, I could make some comments on the Transportation Corps myself.
But
this is mostly operational that you saw. That
yep.
You see any command or authority from the Army?
No. As a matter of fact, Tuesday night when I went downtown, the first area got to before I got to the police station was in the area of the Safeway. Of course, they had the building sandbagged and pumps going, trying to keep the food supply there from getting soaked. And they had armed men there, which I don't really blame them. But there wasn't one of them that could tell me where anybody was set up. And we finally left that group, who were sitting there with the tanked vehicle or tracked vehicles with radios at their, you know, and they wouldn't even think about calling back to their base to find out where civil defense or the state police were set up or who was in charge of the city and so forth. I think the private that was characteristic of downtown Fairbanks was a pretty stupid individual himself. The other thing that I saw was, more often than not, wherever there were a group of civilians and a group of military people side by side trying to get a job done, more often than not I saw the civilians working like mad and working hard, and the soldiers sitting on their fat dust doing nothing, particularly in the police station. Came in with an army truckload of food that they were going to bring upstairs, and it was civilians that carried it in. Guys had been going for many hours, and I still counted, I think it was 12 soldiers just standing around there watching. I'm afraid I'm a little bit bitter about the army in this. But,
did you see that that most of the boat operators had to manage the same way you did, try and get gas from a place that was open, scare up food where they were able to, and this type of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't, other than that one gas station downtown, which was quite clear, it was all you had to do was get there and you got all the gas and oil that you needed. For the most part, everyone had to scrounge up all the fuel and oil that they could on their own. And quite frankly, if it wasn't for the fact that I had a pretty good supply of motorboat oil in my garage, I would have been hard-pressed to be able to continue to operate, because I could get gas, because there was gas floating around, and, you know, in fact, I found one barrel there with about 30 gallons of gas just floating down the street. And one family, we ended up with a 50-gallon barrel of gas that he said, well, let's get it up on the roof. And we, four of us, lifted it into the boat. You can imagine lifting a 50-gallon barrel up about 6 feet, or about 5 feet, I guess, from the boat up onto the roof, so that if we needed some gas, all we had to do was come up to the roof and tap it. And but we did this so that we knew where it was at and it was available to us, and not floating away someplace. But everyone that I talked with said I was operating a boat, come up with the same answer, that if you go to the city police or the state police or any of the other agencies to find out what is needed to be done, you're wasting your time. Do whatever you happen to see that's needed right now. And there was only one, I'll take this back, there was one fellow in the state police force that had a little bit of organization. And there was a fellow, Trooper McQueen, and he was down in the Lomita area. And he ended up organizing in this basis that he would get together a group, he'd determine how many people you would carry in your boat. He'd say, all right, you'll take 20 people, I'll have 20 for you, and you'll be back in about 3/4 of an hour. Yeah. You come back 3/4 of an hour, he had 20 people there for you to load up. You got in the boat, then you were on your way. And he was doing this with all of the boat operators. And he was the only one that I saw that had any amount of organization in what was going on. Of course, he was isolated from the rest of the community with his car. So all he had was his radio in the Lomita area. He couldn't go anywhere. So he just took over in that area, and he did a real fine job.
Was College Road above water at this where he was?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Around the fire station?
Or? No, this was down by B&M Market. That whole stretch in there was above water.
Oh, I see.
And when you come up a little bit further by Kramer's Field, that was underwater.
Mm-hmm.
And just on the other side of the railroad trestle was underwater. By, you know, the Triangle Station was in that area.
Oh, yeah.
You couldn't drive on through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, it was rather a bright spot in the long afternoon to run across somebody that knew what he was doing.
Where did you end up spending most of the evenings?
Well, Tuesday night, I ended up coming back up here on campus. I found Carol, my wife, staying with the Darnells, who, as you know, were all packed up and ready to move out just about the time the flood hit. I left there early in the morning, and Wednesday afternoon, Wednesday night, I stayed at the house, my own house. And on a wet, soggy mattress I was about, well, the bottom edge of the mattress was in the water. But I chose not to sleep up on the roof of my neighbor's house, primarily because it was a four-man tent, and there was four men and one Eskimo, and Chuck was rather fond of the Eskimo, so we decided to let him have the tent, and the three of us went back to our other houses. But Chuck is part Native himself, so I guess it's all right. Thursday, I got back up to the campus and decided to send Carol out with the children. And she went to Seattle. Subsequently, the kids went to Connecticut, and Carol went down to San Francisco. And the remainder of the week, other than Friday night, I was staying at the house. And Friday night, I came up to Dr. Hood's house and had a good dinner and a shower and slept there overnight, and then was back down Saturday morning again. So, I hope that our being, just the very fact that we were there, that there was somebody in the area, kept people out of there from looting. Whether we were there or not, I don't know whether it made any difference. And I think this bit about theft, I think, was probably these two kids, and there's no way of ever really catching up with them, where these rifles were stolen. But,
Well, just to recap a minute, go back to Monday night. What did you think of the situation Monday night? I think there was a little water on the lower side of the Aurora Bridge, wasn't there?
Well, yeah, all day Monday, there was water on the north side of the slough on Aurora, which by noontime you couldn't drive through. It's a particularly low spot in there. I looked at the water. We had to go down through Fairbanks and come up through the railroad yard to get to the house, home from work on Monday night. And I was looking at the water and adding it up with what the statements were on radio and TV about it cresting. I think they were expounding on the fact that it was 16 and a half feet. It was going to crest at 18 and a half feet at midnight. And the crest was 30, 40 miles upstream. You add this up and you say, well, all right, my house is a good 6 feet higher than where the water is now. If it's going to come up another 2 feet, and they know where the crest is, and it's going to, there's no real reason to get real concerned about it. And went to bed at midnight with this thought in mind. Then had it 4 hours later, had it up 5 or 6 feet higher than it was early in the evening. It was rather startling.
This was at 4 o'clock, and it's you.
Yeah, water started coming down in Carr Street about four, and the area is fairly flat out there, and our house is that's probably one of the high points out there, and probably one of the last places to flood in the area.
By this time, you figure that any escape going back to the railroad yard was already cut off.
Oh yeah. It would have been possible to to drive up to Sealand, but even at that point, I never really had any thought that it might go an additional, I think it went up another 5 feet. By 10 or 11, 12, it was, well, yeah, it was by my noontime, the middle of our house was flooded. And by midnight, it had gone up about 2 feet over the main floor. So it crested a full 24 hours later than they said it would, about 6 feet higher than they said it would. Now, what the actual crest was on the Chena, I don't know. Now, this may have been a low spot that started to spill over and filled up. Mm-hmm. And as a result of this increase in height so over such a short period of time. But the fact that Hamilton Acres was flooding Monday night and they were screaming for boats then, I tossed it up in my mind whether I should go over there Monday night and decided not to. On the basis that I felt that there's a real possibility that it was going to be needed in Aurora that night. I felt that it would be better to leave the boat over there and let the fellows who were running boats over there worry about that. And so, other than one other thing was that by the end of the week, of course, we were running short of food. And I think it was Sunday. The water was down far enough where you could get vehicles in. And the Salvation Army came in with a pickup truckload of food and asked us if we would disperse this food to whoever needed it in the amount of about enough food for the families for a 2-day period. And we did this, and it was only just a matter of a few hours, and all the food was pretty well spread out. And after that, when the water, I think it was along about Tuesday or Wednesday that following week, the Red Cross started sending out a lunch wagon, feeding people lunches and whatever food they wanted, which was probably one of the nicest reliefs that I could think of, because he got working on those darn muddy, wet things and not have to stop and cook something or get something ready and have somebody come and say, hey, how about a bowl of soup and some sandwiches? It was quite attractive.
As far as you know, the people from Aurora were never warned, or it was never suggested to them that they get out of their houses. It was more of this constant trying to suggest to them or win them over to evacuate.
Yeah, there was never any, to my knowledge, there was never any statement by any public official or anyone over the radio and so forth that they should evacuate. And as a result, there were a lot of people very hesitant about leaving their homes, and many of them very obviously concerned about what's going to happen after we leave it, you know, concerned for their personal property. And this apprehension, I think, would have been minimized had the Army declared martial law, sent people in and said, we're here, everybody out, we're going to patrol the area. And as long as there's no one there, and the Aurora area is a very easy area to seal off. And in turn, there's only two streets in and out, and the slough runs down through there, and you can patrol that fairly easily. So that I think if people had known that the military was in there patrolling, they would have gotten out of their houses without any apprehension or hesitation. Because I was getting worried about running that darn boat at night, mm-hmm. and getting people who were standing in water with no place to go, and having nightfall come on us, and have a lot of children and people, running down the sloughs and through little alleyways and so forth. At night, it's bad enough during the day, but at night it gets a little bit hairy.
Were very many people apprehensive about where they would be going or what kind of facilities they would run into?
No. they all knew that the university was on high ground, and they all just sort of, well, as long as we're on high ground, we're not in the water, and we're not, you know. There was no real, I didn't sense or spot any concern about whether they were going to get any place to sleep or whether they were going to get any food or not. They were, I think for the most part, once they were in the boat and on their way, they were quite relieved that they were getting out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was the first transition of getting, deciding that, all right, we will get out of the house and get out.
Mm-hmm.
It was the tough one.
Anyway, they were all, you know, how would you characterize their behavior then after you got them in the boat? Docile or apathetic or kind of just stunned?
They were, for the most part, were very docile and stunned, if you can visualize a combination of this. They were docile in that sense that once they got in the boat and sat down, I think with a minor exception of once or twice coming around this one spot, because I tended to try to get the people seated so that they were looking back. And other than that, they would just sort of sit there, and the first few minutes it was, those people that did take food out with them, it was just sort of, well, let's, somebody start opening soda for the kids, and that would quiet the kids down. They had a can of soda in their hand, and they're happy. And appearance would get a beer or a glass of milk or something, and they'd sort of sit down and start looking around and enjoy the ride. But I don't think any of them really enjoyed the ride, except maybe the kids. But I didn't have any signs of anyone that even bordered on what you might call hysteria or anything like this. For which I was duly grateful, because that's all I needed was somebody to get excited and start to lose control of themselves.
You mentioned the kids. How about were the kids generally, under control and that kind of thing?
Yeah. I think it was for the most part, most of the kids were pretty much in the control of their parents, and in a few instances. I ended up did jump in and order the kids to do certain things like sit down or, you know, and stop moving around this thing. And here, they obeyed immediately, I think for the simple reason that here was someone else who spoke with them. Sounded like a very authoritative voice, and they weren't quite sure whether they should defy it or not. And but I can't say that I had anything that any bordered on a problem. I tend to be very cautious with a boat and people and kids in a boat because the water is being so darn cold. You get one kid off in the water, even if he's got a life jacket. Sure, you can get back to them, but you're down a narrow slough and you got a big current with you. You might end up quite a ways before you can get turned around, and you may get washed off into some bushes and so forth. And you can probably spend 5 or 10 minutes before you get back to them. By this time, the little youngster might be in serious trouble. So I have always, even just normal usage, I've always insisted that kids wear life jackets and that they stay seated and down on the floor. I won't even let them sit on the seat. And it's just a perk that I have about boating up here in this area. But the kids were probably the best for the whole bunch of them, of all the people I took out. But I don't know what else I might say about this. I'm sure half an hour from the time we finish, I'll remember something else that should be in there. But I think in summing it up, I think there's just a general lack of authority expressed by any group that should have been an authority or could have been an authority. Most of the people knew what had to be done. There were a few isolated cases of people who were acting rather peculiarly, but these were pretty well handled. at least to the people that I was in contact with. And I think maybe this is in part due to the nature of the general makeup of the people who are willing to live in this country up here anyway. And I think if the same thing had happened in some other community in Lower 48, I think it might have been a different story. But service organizations like Salvation Army and the Red Cross, as far as I was concerned, did an excellent job. In fact, I think the Red Cross has been a lot more in Fairbanks than I or anyone else ever expected they might do.
And, I think they changed a lot of people's minds.
I'm very impressed with their operation. Of course, they are, quite frankly, are geared much more to the aftermath and helping getting restored rather than right at the immediate moment. There, I think the Salvation Army was fulfilling the bill right nicely. Mm-hmm. So,
that's it then. Anything else?
No, I guess that's all I got to.